From Noble Robot on East Hennepin Avenue in spirited Minneapolis, this is Nice Games Club, the show where nice game devs talk games and game development. I'm Ellen Burns-Johnson, and I make nice games.
I'm Steve McGregor, and I make nice games.
And I'm Mark McCroy, I too make nice games.
For this week's episode, our topics are targeting multiple platforms and Spirit Island Spirits, plus some meta at the top. So, if everyone's ready, let's start.
I'm looking forward to explaining what both our topics today mean, Stephen.
Yeah. They're kind of vague, but like if we explain it any further in the topics, then like that's the title for the episode.
Listeners are going to have to wait.
Yeah.
For a very short time, because I just got to talk about my no good, very bad week.
Yeah.
Just like a weird string of bad luck. You ever have that thing where you just think like there's got to be a reason, but there's just nothing?
Mm-hmm.
So we do Twin Cities Playtest here every month where developers come, they put their games on the machines here at Noble Robot. And then they're all networked to my workstation at my desk. And then that is put through an OBS setup. So we have this multi-channel video stream that we can switch between. It's a real, you know, it's a fancy thing that I set up and works great every month. Mm-hmm. But this week, 40 minutes before we were due to start, but the network card on my workstation like fried out and wouldn't connect to the internet. And at the exact same time, well, probably within an hour, whatever. The driver for my Wi-Fi card also stopped working.
Oh goodness!
To me it was like the internet is down.
Yeah.
right. So
right.
I spent half that time diagnosing that. Oh. Turns out two separate, completely separate problems.
Wow.
And so there's backup plans. Ugh. Like if we just cancel the stream, people can still come. It's a public event. We have tons of people playing games. It's great.
Right.
It's fine.
Mm-hmm.
But like, I don't want to do that. I want it to work.
Yeah.
So I scrambled. I got out Dale's laptop and I spent the next half an hour getting the entire setup, like the broadcast technology, the plugins for OBS, all of the overlays and stuff I had to rescue from the machine using a thumb drive because there was no way for it to communicate with any other machine otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
And getting all that set up, moving all the actual physical USB devices that are like running the cameras and microphones and stuff that are all throughout the space, getting those routed over to Dale's desk instead of mine, making sure that she had Ethernet, local Ethernet, instead of the Wi-Fi on the local network, because that's the only way that the internal streams really... All of this stuff I'm like frantically doing as people are walking in the door.
Yeah.
And like also cognizant that it doesn't matter that much, but like... So we started 15 minutes late, which I'm pretty happy with, and it went okay. There was some, you know, little hiccups.
Sure.
Because also the microphone that we use, that Dale walks around with like a handheld microphone on like a giant cord, like Bob Barker, and like interviews people playing games.
Yeah.
And then that goes on the stream and the developers can look at that later and they can hear more player pester feedback because there's somebody out there talking to them. It's a really great way to sort of keep things going. Dale is a fantastic host of the event.
Mm-hmm.
And she's walking around with the microphone and then like it stops working and I'm like monitoring the stream the whole time.
Oh, God.
Mostly out of paranoia, but like usually it's fine. But this time I'm glad I was like on the ball with it because the device just failed. Again, totally separate issue.
Wow.
So we had her use her phone, and then she entered a Discord chat room with her phone, and then I put that as an OBS layer because I also entered it on her laptop.
Yeah, wow.
And then buried that in the layers on the OBS setup so that she had a roving microphone that was just her phone.
Mm-hmm.
That worked fine.
Okay.
We might do that permanently. Audio is not as good.
Yeah.
But that was like, you know, on the fly. And every time we switched to another machine, it was a new scene in OBS. And anyone who knows how that works knows that when you make a change, it's only in the scene. And so when you like switch the setup to a different thing, you have to do it again. So I had to remember microphone's broken still. So that was like a whole thing.
Goodness.
And then the next day, I'm like, oh, well, my computer doesn't connect to the internet. I have to deal with that tomorrow at work.
Right.
Like, you know, how am I supposed to copy things from Stack Overflow if I don't have the internet?
Yeah.
Can't get any work done. So at home, I'm scrambling for, like, do I have any, like, you know, USB Wi-Fi cards or anything like that? And so I found two different ones that I've just collected over the years to connect old desktops. And brought that in as well as like an Ethernet to USB adapter, thinking like maybe I can still make that work.
Yeah.
The Wi-Fi cards didn't work.
Okay.
And I was like, well, I can maybe, it's probably the same driver powering it. But I plugged in the Ethernet jack, the USB, and that did work.
Yeah.
I'm like, okay, that's fine. It's a little tiny Realtek controller in there. Okay, that worked, but the internet was really, really slow. Hmm. And I was like, okay, well, it must be like a bad, the device must just be bad. I'm like, well, okay, that's all right. Turns out, no, the internet is just really slow in the neighborhood right now.
Yeah.
And we're still actually facing that today.
Yeah, we are.
At the office.
It's still pretty slow.
A completely unrelated issue, again.
Okay.
But I spent an hour trying to figure out like how that's working until I finally just checked another device in the office that it was working and was connected fine. And so it's been, the week has been marked by things that are broken, but not for the reason that it's obvious that it would be obvious. So.
Right.
And then I was like, okay, great. We had this event last night. I need a rest. I'm just going to clean up in here. Mm. And like, I'm like taking apart my computer. Mm. So like, let's clear the dust out of it. And so I'm like, well, I'll get my little handheld vacuum and get some of the, you know, the dust off some of the things around here.
Yeah.
Turns out the vacuum's broken.
No! Gosh.
And was it the battery? Was it the motor? Was it the charging? I couldn't figure it out.
Yeah.
And I was like, okay, I think I figured out it was the charging station for the little handheld vacuum.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, okay, great. That's the cheapest part. I'll just go online and buy a replacement. It's only a couple of years old.
Sure.
Turns out, nope, they don't sell it anymore. So I can go to eBay and get something, but it's
so
used.
Frustrating.
And if it's not actually the problem, if it's actually the battery, then I can't return it. So like now I don't know, I'm going to buy a new vacuum. I don't know what I'm going to do.
Yeah.
And then my bike tire caught a leak and went flat.
Just to add insult to injury.
Yeah. I don't know. What is it? Just the stupidest week.
It sucks.
So like all of these are boring stories. I'm sorry for relaying them to you, but all happened in like 2 or 3 days.
Yeah.
Like,
so it just compiles and it just makes the rest of the week suck.
Yeah, and I was working on shaders this week. So I was already not having fun.
So sucks.
I'm pleased at the end of the week to be here with my two pals to talk about whatever it is we're gonna talk about. Which is what? Oh, it's my topic.
It is.
I'm going to talk about targeting multiple platforms.
Okay.
Now, this is something that, like, listeners will be like, you've certainly talked about that a lot, Mark.
Mm.
And yes, I have. We talked about porting your game in episode 175.
Yes.
Kapow, the name of that episode.
Title.
And I went and listened back to that because I'm like, I know I have talked about this, but it's definitely on my mind now. All the projects I'm working on are multi-platform. And that was really about my time porting Metro Nexus from its original code base, like its ancient Flash code base, to a Haxi code base.
Right.
And it's still pretty interesting, but a lot of it was focused on what I was working on at the time, which is really a lot of times how we frame our topics. And we talked a lot about, like, when you make a game, like a Unity game, what do you do when it's time then to port it?
Right.
And I think what I want to focus on now is, like, setting yourself up for success, thinking about multiple platforms from the beginning.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's not always within the capacity of indie developers.
Mm.
Even if you do have access to dev kits for consoles, for example, or you're making a PC game that you want to do on mobile, the actual day-to-day testing on multiple things is like, I'm not going to go as far as to say, like, have a bunch of things set up. I will say have a bunch of controllers at your desk. That's nice.
Yeah.
To get some sort of semblance of it. But a lot of it is conceptual.
Yeah.
You can think about designing for multiple platforms from the design stage.
To emphasize the difference between the two topics, I have not ported a game from one place to another place, but I have worked on making sure to target multiple platforms.
Okay.
So, like, I have a little bit of expertise with respect to that. To emphasize the difference between these two different topics, I have not ported a game from one project to another. Or one platform to another.
Mm-hmm.
But I have made a game intending to put it on, like, Switch or Xbox.
Yeah.
So I have more expertise with this than I did with the other project, the other topic, just to make it clear that they're different.
Yeah, and then when you worked on Treasure Stack, a different team did a lot of the porting to Xbox. You did the Switch port, but but it was concurrent.
Right, yeah.
It was a little overlapping, though, right?
Yeah, so it was kind of, well, I could talk about it a little bit. Mm-hmm. When I first started working on Treasure Stack, I had intentions to, you know, we knew we were going to put it on Switch, and I think we intended to put it on Xbox the whole time as well.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't, like, actually know what that entailed. So I, like, I knew that Switch was going to be rough. So I tried to be as, like, efficient as I could with the code, but I was not as good a programmer as I am now.
Yeah, that's one of the things you hear is, like, build for the lowest common denominator.
Yeah.
Right? Unless you're going to really be working with, like, quality settings and different graphics, you know, and different, you know, this different LOD setup for this, you know, platform, and this different LOD combination for this platform,
right,
and blah, blah, blah. Which I think a lot of, you know, indie developers, even if you're in a fourth or fifth project, like, that's sort of out of scope a lot of times for smaller teams. So yeah, design for the least common denominator, but that also, like, does that limit you? Mm-hmm. You know, but like, that's why you think about this from the beginning. If you're like, this is going to be a system, a game, it's going to be great on X. Like, where it's like, oh, you know what? There's all these like handheld PCs that are coming out, right?
Yeah.
And true. Some of them are kind of underpowered though. Like they're, you know, and so like I should design for that, but it's a PC game. So you don't really think about that. You kind of just like there's uncapped potential.
Yeah.
And so it's helpful to think about those limits. But in a way that, I mean, it's always, I always say it's exciting to design inside of a box with limits. I think you should go with, you know, as true as that is sometimes and as not true as it is other times.
Yeah.
Think about that in, as a way to excite you. And so, yeah, it's really just about like thinking about it from day one and never stop thinking about it.
Yeah.
Like, don't think of think. And it's really important to think of your the machine you're designing on as your development machine.
Yeah.
And I think that's like an important psychological barrier to it. It's a lot of times when you're making a PC game on PC, I think people know this intellectually that like this it's not going to run on this machine everywhere,
right?
But I think there's a when you really think about it, when you test it, to always make sure you're thinking them in your mind. I'm just running it in a test environment, and think of sort of it's an agnostic, you know, runtime that's you know, and that is like it's really not. Actionable advice, but when you just sort of have that kind of thinking, it really helps you think about, especially when you think about like different screen sizes and different control methods. When you're testing, I think there's so many indie developers, and we have the games that come in at playtest all the time that are always like really, really far along.
Yeah.
And they're like, I'm thinking about adding controller support.
Oh, no.
and it's like, okay, when?
Yeah.
You know, when it's relevant or when I have time to. And it's like, well, that's a first-class control scheme, like on PC as well. And I think it's just because there are things it's easy to put off because you just can. And you can, I mean, I've seen so many platformers that haven't shipped with controller support.
Yeah.
And like, you know, for shame. But like, but you know, you can do that, right? That's your choice to do.
Right.
But I think the reason that happens is because developers are way too long in the process. And then they're like, well, it's working fine. I've played it a bunch. I'm enjoying it myself. I've tested it with some people. They don't seem to have that much of a problem with it. Like they ask, but like it's fine. And then they're just like, well, it is what it is at that point. And I think that it makes it harder to then decide to do that because you're already exhausted. Yeah. It's already taking you know more than you thought it was going to take.
Right.
You're on you know, the third 90% of the project just to get it out the door.
Yes,
onto itch or Steam or whatever. And if that's something that you did intend to do. Then it's something you should have gotten a start on really early, even if you didn't have to.
Right.
So that's a good example.
Yeah.
So I'm going to go through some more of these, but I want to talk about the projects I'm working on and where my frame of mind is, because like I said, I was listening to that old episode and like, that's how it was framed about like what I was working on. And I thought that was a helpful way to get me to sort of remember all of the aspects of the thing.
Yeah.
So I'm working on Operators. That's a mobile game. It's Android as the prime platform, but I'm thinking about iOS for it as well. I don't have a lot of iOS devices around, but I have an old iPad Mini, which I think will work. That's one. But I'm the whole way through, I'm thinking about screen sizes, screen density, layouts, and I'm thinking about inputs. So the different methods of back gestures on iOS versus Android, making sure I sort of account for all of that. In the design,
and then
emulating that when I run it on my PC,
yeah.
And that one's a little bit easier because it is a mobile game that I'm developing on a PC, so it's really easy to separate that out. But most of my deployments for performance testing and stuff is on Android because that's what I'm working with now. But when it's time to do iOS, it's going to be a whole other thing.
Yeah,
with their provisioning profiles and all that nonsense. And I don't have as much access to those devices, but I'm already making sure that I have as few surprises as possible when I get to that. I'm designing for that platform as well.
Okay.
I'm also thinking it's a touchscreen game. It's a mobile game. One of the unheralded or unrealized benefits of the Switch is that it's a tiny little tablet.
Right. It's true.
Operators is a game that you can play like Battleship. You can set it on a table and two players can play across the screen.
Yeah.
It was designed originally as a tablet game. And so I'm like, I could make a Switch version. Like,
you could.
It wouldn't be that tricky.
Like, when the Switch first came out, there were a few games that came out that were kind of, like, mobile only.
Yeah, it's not. The Nintendo platform guidelines will allow you to make a game that has no controller support, that is touchscreen only.
Yeah.
It's kind of crazy because that seems like they should not. You should have to dock it. That should be but they'll let you throw up a screen and say, no, this is a mobile game.
Mm-hmm.
Almost no games have done that.
Right.
And so it's not a huge market, but I am also thinking about how it would work on that, especially because that screen is very low resolution. That's something I'm thinking about, like, you know, compared to all the other devices I'm working with, it's like half the resolution of most things. And also thinking like, well, maybe how would this look with, like, with controller support? So I've gotten, I've written down like how, you know, and every time I think about like navigating from screens or operating the you know, the actual gameplay, which is just pick, you know, one answer from eight. It's a very simply controlled game.
Yeah.
But I'm thinking about what would that look like with a controller? Like how fast would that go? And I have to adjust how the timers work to account for the sort of left, 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 down, enter rather than just tap, you know? So that's something that I'm thinking about. That's sort of back of mind. That one I think is going to be more I port to after I finish it.
Sure.
Yeah. I'm making sure I don't lock myself away from that possibility. Dream Settler, other big project. That's the biggest project I'm working on. Yeah. We've been designing for multi-platform from the start. PC console. It would be cool. I think that game could work on like Android TV, Apple TV, that kind of thing. Because what we're doing is we're designing for the multiple controls is really important for us. We're making sure that every system we build, it's this fake OS, so it's very mouse and keyboard. And in fact, mouse and keyboard is how the original HypnoSpace was designed, because it's a desktop simulator. It's meant to be like a computer, so it's a PC game. And then they had to add controller support later to work with consoles, and it works with PC as well, of course. And so that was something that like they had some trouble with, and we've been thinking about it from the beginning. So we're making design choices about like how this would work that are maybe not, there's advantages where we could take from having mouse and keyboard only.
Sure.
But we're like, what if someone only has a keyboard?
Yeah.
Like what can they play this game? What if someone only has a mouse or only wants to use a mouse?
Yeah.
Right. Because that sometimes, especially it is essentially it's kind of a point and click game.
Mm-hmm.
So all of our mini games, all of our like applications, that none of them require the arrow keys.
Yeah.
None of them require typing. They can all be used with a mouse.
Wow.
And the way that the cursor works, we're letting you, we have this snapping system for different like mouse targets. We're making sure that can work with analog joysticks, D-pads, you know, arrow keys, and not having to worry about which control method you have. And so a lot of that is also an accessibility thing, a win.
Right.
But it didn't come from that.
Yeah.
That sort of cemented it. It's like, we definitely need to do this because we also get all these other benefits.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of it was just like, well, we don't know, you know, people can, when I played HypnoSpace, actually, I plugged in a keyboard to my Switch dock.
Oh, wow.
That's how I played HypnoSpace Outlaws. I played the Switch version originally. You know, people can plug in keyboards to all, and I actually don't think they knew that it was just because that was like a legacy of a control scheme.
Yeah.
I don't know if they even knew that was a thing you could do when they shipped that version.
That's hilarious.
So for that game, we're definitely thinking about those controls, because a lot of the immersion of that game is the experience of handling its components. Mm-hmm. It's a game with that has nothing but UI.
Yeah.
So like that's a really important part of that. Really learning from the previous experiences that the Tendershoot team had on HypnoSpace, and then also recently with Slayer's X, the spinoff game that Jay had been working on. I've been sort of like following along with that process. The game came out last year, and learning about how that porting process worked, and frankly, learning from the mistakes. They ended up forking that project because it had to go to a different team. And that happened before the project was finalized. Which is the worst thing you can do.
That's bad.
Everybody kind of knew it. People make those choices for lots of reasons, but I think the one big piece of advice I would give for people for targeting multiple platforms is like, even if you're not going to be the one to ship your Switch version, like make sure that when it's time, and the porting team that's working on it, like or that you've hired, or another person on your team, or another people on your team, one code base.
That is the
key thing. There are times when that's not easier said than done. But the moment you fork it off, then suddenly version 1.0.1, you got to cross those things.
You have to port it. It's a porting process at that point.
Right? Yeah, and it's amazing how you're like, well, that won't be that hard. And like those are famous last words.
Yeah.
But that's the Slayer's X is in that situation now, where the Xbox, PlayStation, Switch, and PC version, they're all different code bases. With they have different, you know, they're No More Robots has a great bug tracking system, so like they're, you know, they're doing their best, right? And like it's not, they made some mistakes in like architecturally delivering that stuff, but like they're doing the best job that anyone could in that situation, and there were reasons that they did it that way, so I'm not, this isn't like a hit on them or anything, that is, as time goes on, that is getting harder and harder, and people are less excited about the fact that they have to like backport all these different changes with different teams working on them, right? Because you can have a porting team like working on something, they can fix your regular bugs too.
Yeah.
Like, but wouldn't you want those bugs fixed? Like, on your, in the sort of the home project?
Yeah.
So that's communication is important when you have those fork projects, but the big advice is do not fork your project.
Okay. Yeah.
And I don't honestly know how that scales to AAA. Be interesting to have a guest on to talk about that.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
You know, how those sorts of things work with custom engines or with huge Unreal projects.
Yeah.
Because with Unreal is a whole different thing for multiple platforms. It's actually quite a lot harder to do. But definitely if you're working on an indie game, like, don't you dare make a branch in Git that says, console version.
Xbox. Yeah. We didn't do that in Treasure Tech either, thank goodness.
Yeah,
because that would have sucked.
And then this other project I'm working on that hasn't been announced yet. Similar, designing for multiple platforms. That one has more form factors, and I'm working with an existing design, but not an existing code base. So I have a lot of freedom to sort of enforce a lot of compatibilities.
Yeah.
Early going, and I'm going to be in charge of builds on that. So that's pretty exciting, but. It's a different process, and I really can't wait to talk more about it, but that'll happen later. Mm-hmm. So we talked a lot about controls. I think one of the things people are, concerned about for accessibility especially is button remapping, but that's something you have to build in your project anyway because you're working with Nintendo and Xbox controllers.
Right.
And, there's definitely, and I think there's a school of thought, which is like everyone wants that confirm button on the bottom of the face buttons where the A is on an Xbox controller. And like, there's plenty of Nintendo indie games that just use B for confirm. They just don't. It's fine.
Yeah.
Yes, it's fine, but that's not how it is in the system menus, and that will be confusing to people.
Yes.
And I am very much a believer in I'm going to deal with all the multiple platforms, but the person playing the game is playing it on that platform.
Right.
So I think it is actually important to on Switch. Or on games with unusual control schemes, and Switch is the, Nintendo is the main outlier at this point.
Yeah.
The convergence of controllers is kind of wild. Makes things easier than ever before.
Yeah, even PlayStation is falling on board with that now.
Right. Like, it used to be that the
circle was confirming, at least in Japan.
In Japan. And there's tools in the SDK to, like, that are sort of like system SDK level tools to swap that for you, so you don't have to do it in your game.
Yeah,
and then the user just it's a setting on the console that's a default, and then the user can change it. Mm. And that's neat. I think but PlayStation 5 has removed that functionality because they're like, listen, it's just time. Just time for everyone to use the same thing.
We lost that fight.
And it's kind of amazing because Xbox is not that popular in Japan.
Yeah,
and that's why I think it took PlayStation this long, is because they were very dominant. And it was similar to Nintendo. So it was, for the Japanese gaming audience, there wasn't actually that much confusion.
That's true.
We're the ones who had to deal with it, mostly here in the West. But,
we're the problem.
Yeah. But it is important to think about, making sure that your system works with those things. And that means, like, okay, your main button is going to be B on the Switch, right? Because that's the bottom. That's the jump button. It feels good. You're using Y on the left to do something that needs to have your thumb next to it. So there you go, right?
Yeah.
Mario games use A and B to jump. Right, there's no more B button run. It's X and Y button run now, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so, because of ergonomics, and so you're gonna think about that same thing. But then when you go to the menus, you're like, well, I'm gonna follow the Switch conventions, and I'm gonna use A for confirm and B for back. But suddenly, that actually is more of a mode switch for players because there is the main action button. It's the whole principle of the GameCube controller, right?
Yeah.
It's like this button is big and green because you're using it for all the time in all contexts. It's the main button all the time.
Right.
So if you're designing a game and you're going to follow those conventions for system menus, think also about your actual gameplay controls. Like, maybe a jump should be on B.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe, run or the alternate action or attack or whatever. A lot of platformers have, two main buttons, should be on X at the top instead of, Y at the side.
Yeah.
Or think about the way Mario does it, which is like Mario refuses to do more than two actions with those four buttons.
Yeah.
Like they'll overload the shoulder buttons before they put anything else on the face.
Mm-hmm.
Although I think maybe Wonder did something, I don't remember. But think about that, like duplicating functionality so that people don't have to do that switching between menus and gameplay, even though it doesn't feel like they're that connected. So there's more to it than just the actual mapping. There's the design and the philosophy of it.
Yeah.
And think about that. And then, if someone has a game on PC and then they play it on their Switch and it's a little different, that's a pretty small you know, segment of your audience.
Yeah.
You're the one who's going to be the most frustrated by that. So when you think about how that's a little bit confusing to toggle back and forth with, think about really almost no one else is going to be facing that. So you have to kind of block it out of your mind when you're thinking of it. You have to sort of imagine yourself as a different person in each of those cases. But that's, I mean, controls, that's part of all almost all we talked about so far.
Yeah.
The next thing is really important is save data. And this is just a highly technical aspect.
Yes.
Basically, you need a way to access the, you know, the cold storage of every system you're working
and
on.
And they all do it differently.
They all do it differently.
And it's so obnoxious.
Yay!
Yeah. So this is a little like leading pitch. Like I'm building a set of tools that, you know, makes data handling and serialization generic across devices.
Oh, thank goodness.
So I'll be putting that on the Unity Asset Store probably in the next year.
Okay.
So stay tuned for that. But in the meantime, you got to do it yourself. There are other tools available out there for you.
Yeah.
But the goal, I think, and this is just because what I'm building for these projects is you want a single API. You want to say save system dot save parentheses the thing you want to save,
and
you just want that to work across all platforms. And so that's how I'm building this tool of mine, is to have that generic API. You know, you'll have these like if blocks or conditional blocks in your code.
Mm-hmm.
You want to have those as far away from you as possible.
Yeah.
Right. You know, if you want to have like, oh, this is my save this data. If it's this platform, it's this platform, this platform. Use these different APIs to save and load this object. You know, fine. But you actually want that out of your code base and into a library if possible. And that's a library you build yourself. And see previous episode on that topic. But that's the goal, because you'll definitely find yourself halfway through your project and you'll be doing something that functionality you haven't built yet, and then you'll end up having those if blocks for the different platforms, and then you'll lose track of it. And as soon as you have the instinct to do that, package it up and stick it in a utilities class, bury it deep in a library you built, or look into third-party options to sort of simplify your life a little bit more on that sort of stuff. But the basic thing is structuring your data so that it is easily retrievable and savable. I have opinions on JSON, which is I don't like it, but it is, I think, the standard. Like, you want to serialize all your data as a text file.
Yeah.
That's the least, I believe that. That's true. So I'm coming at it from a bias of, like, not liking JSON as a format.
Sure.
And not particularly... I feel like people can handle binary serialization.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't know what I'm talking about, don't worry about it. Just follow the advice everyone gives you, which is to, like, you want to take all your objects and data and you want to save it, you know, in the simplest format possible. And usually that means that's JSON.
Yeah.
XML used to be really popular. Same kind of thing. Just a hierarchy of information stored as strings. And those can be ones and zeros and trues and falses, but it's ultimately just strings that you have to interpret.
Yeah.
So what that means is you have to be very judicious about what you save.
Yeah.
Think about when you're saving a player state, you know, don't just serialize the whole player class.
Right.
Because there's going to be lots of information in there that gets regenerated on every runtime. You don't need a lot of it.
Yeah.
That's outside the scope of this topic, but it's something to think about, because when you're thinking about different systems, you're going to be like dealing with the same types of information a lot, and you want to, the simpler you can make it and the more reliable you can make it, the better. And that is a lot of work up front. It's so, in the old days when you would just use the C# binary serializer to just save any object of any kind to disk cheaply, fast, no problem. Those days are gone.
Yeah.
I mean, you can still do it, but like, it's not recommended. And you cannot really apply that process. It's not that easy on other platforms.
Yeah.
Other platforms have their own APIs, which are, you know, behind the NDAs on those platforms. But basically, almost all of them use a journaling system.
Mm-hmm.
And what that means is you save to a cache in RAM. And then once it's confirmed that all your object is it's not in RAM necessarily, but it's a journaled area where all your data goes. And then once it's all there and you're done saving it, then you commit it to the hard disk. And that is a way to save... errors in the case of a system fault. So the save to the final step of writing it to disk is as fast as it can possibly be, because there's no overhead from assembling and structuring it. This is kind of a very crude description of the benefits, but a journaled file system is such that if in a power failure in the middle of a save, you didn't corrupt your disk.
Yeah.
Right. because right. there's a very only a very short moment when you're actually writing a disk, as short as it possibly be in order yeah. to be safe.
Right.
And all the consoles work this way, and you have to access those APIs and get comfortable with the idea of like a two-step process.
Yeah.
Now, you're dealing with your own APIs. If you're abstracting a lot of that, then, you know, that's great. But, and then, you know, you also may want to think about journaling your data on PC. Think about having a cached area that you save to, and that can be on disk, right? And if the system fails, that's corrupted, but that's fine. You never read from that area.
Mm.
What happens is that you save to this thing to disk. Once you can then confirm by reading it again that it's saved correctly, and you can do a hash if you want. You can. You don't have to be that. This is not data security stuff.
Yeah. But
then you then copy that to where it needs to go.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a really simple way to do essentially journaling in another term on PC. And that is also, you know, to just, yeah, guard against failures.
Yeah.
Because the thing you don't want from your players is like, they're like, I have a corrupted save file. Can you fix it?
Right.
Because you don't know if you, because you may not be able to.
Yeah.
That's another, we, you know, save data is a whole other topic, but like having systems to be able to open up save files and actually just manually repair them. And that is why, actually, that having a text file as your save data is really the easiest way, because you don't need to build a tool
yeah.
to actually access and modify it.
Yeah.
As long as you know how it's supposed to look, you can hand type it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
If a player's having difficulty and they're like, how do I, you know, do this? Or like, this thing is broken. And you look like, oh, looks like things happen out of order because of a bug or whatever. You say, give me your save file. I'll just fix it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, it's a thing you can actually do.
Yeah.
And that's why, that's one of the reasons why people argue for just plain text.
Yeah.
Kind of, it also lets players cheat, which is fun,
mm-hmm.
right?
That's the thing about this topic, is like it encompasses so many different things, because all consoles do everything differently in a lot of specific, unique ways.
Yeah,
that is kind of difficult to like wrap your head around initially.
Well, that's why every time I get into one of these little sub areas, right. it starts just being about that.
Yeah,
because and it's really just about taking the best of all the different platforms and bringing it, you know, all together. And that's true for all these things. So the, yeah. you know, we talk about this at the top, but like, performance, you know, that least common denominator idea, like that's great. You know, if that's how it's going to work for you, and that is the best way to do it,
mm-hmm.
Or the most reliable way to do it, especially if you're indie, is to test on the lowest possible thing.
Yeah.
Sometimes that's difficult. Sometimes all you have is your gaming laptop.
Right.
You don't actually have a way to test other things.
Yeah.
So that's a way to like bring friends in, get, you know, dig an old laptop from a long time ago. If you've got one. Go to a thrift shop and see if you can find a really cheap computer that's still compatible
yeah.
to run a test on.
Mm-hmm.
I would say at the same time, do not concern yourself with like having a suite of devices if that's going to cost you a lot of money.
Yeah.
I don't know that that's worth it, right?
Sure, yeah.
Sometimes it's better to just think conceptually and be a little bit in the dark than to fork over hundreds of thousands of dollars to be sure.
Yeah.
So as much as I'm very much for crossing T's and dotting I's, like, there's a certain point where you just have to trust your own expertise on how this is going to work. And then when it doesn't, then you deal with the fallout,
mm-hmm.
right? So there's no, you know, you're going to have to find your own balance for what works for you.
Yeah.
Some people also find it really fun to work on old devices and to test old things. Like, that actually feels a validating part of the process. If that is you, then this will come easier to you, and this will be more exciting for you and more validating, more rewarding. If it's not you, then it's a slog, and maybe you don't have to do as much of it.
Yeah.
So that's the main thing about my advice here as well, is that if you're a small team or a single person doing this kind of work, you still do have to tune it the way you do all your other work. Focus on what you enjoy doing, what gives you the most satisfaction,
yeah.
and then make sure you're not skipping out on the things that have to be done. And then the things you don't like to do, make sure your design does not depend on those things as much,
yeah.
because then you'll have to do them.
Yeah.
Right?
True.
So that's, I mean, that all, there's if there's stuff that's giving you trouble and your design calls for it, then maybe it's time to change your design
mm-hmm.
Rather than struggle through the thing you don't want to do. Or, I mean, again, you could also struggle through the thing you don't want to do because it's that important to you. Those are all choices you can make. And mm-hmm. that comes down to all of this stuff.
Right.
And performance is really key to that.
Yeah.
Because it's one of the hardest things to do if you don't have a team for it. You
yeah.
don't have a lot of like computer science background, which I know I don't. And so
a lot
of times I'm like throwing up a profile uh-huh. and I'm like, great, I think this is all right. Like you trace where the things are happening. Like
yeah.
you do figure like you're learning everything anew each time you end up doing this if it's not part of your background.
Yeah.
I'm also used to, in the old days, I would use a lot of profiling tools that were actually much more powerful than are available to me now as a game developer.
Mm-hmm.
And so I feel like I learned all this stuff that I can't use because the tools are not good enough.
Yeah.
And so I get really frustrated and I'm just like, all right, I'll just do the crudest fix, and rather than try to pinpoint the perfect balance
Yeah.
Because that's not a thing I love to do.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So I make sure I'm not dependent on this.
Yeah. I know I said that I like really worked hard to try to make sure that Treasure's Deck was like going to be able to work on Switch by like trying to be optimal and stuff.
Yeah.
I don't know what I'm talking about. I have no idea how to do this.
Revealed. Yeah. But when it comes to multiple platforms, like think about loading assets, and how much RAM a device has, right? This is phones are like loaded with RAM these days, I guess, unless you're on iOS. But like make sure that, you know, you're not loading every scene and every asset into memory at start time, because that's not going to fly very much on consoles and on low powered devices.
Yeah.
Think about managing your memory and thinking about the lowest common denominator there as well. Think about designing for arbitrary performance. So not assuming load times, for example. This is a great way to design on a gaming PC, but design for a lower powered PC without needing to have one, which is to say, like, work with callbacks. Like, when something needs to load and it needs to load from disk and it happens in like half a second, like, that's fine, but don't also have a code routine running that's 4 seconds long that assumes it's going to be loaded at the end of that coroutine. Like, you can get into a lot of trouble doing that.
Yeah.
And so always make sure that when you're doing these things, imagine it's running on a potato, and if it's going to take 25 minutes, like, think about it, really. If this thing you're doing that normally takes half a second, if it took 25 minutes, how would your code need to work in order for that to be okay?
Yeah.
And that includes things like visuals. Like, how do I show to the player that something is loading? If something loads so quickly, where's the threshold by which I tell the player that, oh, something's loading, versus like, I don't need to tell them because it's already loaded, right? So these are all, there's visual elements to consider as well.
Mm-hmm.
And so think about that, because you'll run your game on two different devices and it will work differently.
Yeah.
Things will load in faster or slower, and you want that to be one experience. And you would want to do that without having to go to, like, if it's this platform, do it this way. If it's that platform, do it this way. You want your code to just assume that it's running on an arbitrary platform.
Yeah.
That is, you know, another sort of big key to this topic is, like, don't, when you're making it, don't assume anything about anything.
Yeah.
That might be a little bit too harsh. But, like, yeah, just imagine any system specs. And this is also where you determine what your minimum system specs are.
Mm.
You know, instead of just guessing when it's time to upload it to Steam, which is what we all kind of do.
Yeah.
And the last thing is sort of, I want to talk about is just about unique hardware and platform features.
Mm.
This would just be a thing, and I'm sure you can go back, where, especially when I was doing Widget Satchel, I was thinking about, like, oh, it's so cool that we get to do, I mean, just doing the HD rumble sound effects on the controllers, where you can actually hear Sprocket making the duking noises in your hands.
Yeah.
That was so fun.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, it's also such a minor part of that game, and it's not on the PC version. I spent a ton of time on it,
yeah.
But so few games leverage hardware and platform unique features, including things like, you know, people just port their achievements to trophies, and all the platforms have kind of coalesced around similar things.
Yeah.
The convergence on platforms is so tight that even though you do still need to keep thinking about what's different about them, I'm maybe less... This is where I want to, like, bring you guys in, because I've been chatting, just yapping this whole time, about as players especially.
Yeah.
Because I was always very much on a soapbox about this. Like, always think about the unique things you could do. Leverage the light bar on the PS4 controller. Like, work with the cool stuff that the Switch can do. Like, you know, that's important. But now I'm like, maybe it's just me that wants that. I don't actually, in the past couple of years especially, I just don't think it's actually hurting you that much to not pay as much attention to that. So I wonder if my advice on that is just now outdated. What do you think?
Excellent question. I think that players do recognize, they probably won't send you like a Twitter or whatever being like, thank you for putting this specific thing in the game.
Yeah.
But I think that players do recognize, like, with the light bar changes, different color if you're playing a different character or something like that. I think that players do appreciate those small things. Sometimes, especially the little details.
Yeah.
Especially like when it comes to like the light bar thing, because I think that's on PlayStation. Because like I think that a lot of people, that's visually, people can see it.
Yeah.
And so they'll be able to tell, like, when you're, I know that I appreciated it when I was playing Forspoken. Like, if I was on a different, like, magic mode or whatever, it would swap the different colors.
Mm-hmm.
And it was helpful for me to sometimes be able to see that, to know what I was, which magic I was using at the time.
Yeah.
So I think that, like, it's kind of one of those subtle things that people don't necessarily notice but can feel.
Mm-hmm.
But they'll notice it if it's not there.
Sure.
Sort of things. Especially since, like, I think that when people play on PlayStation 5, they play a lot of the games exclusively on PlayStation 5, right?
Mm-hmm.
So They're assuming that a lot of those features are going to be in there because, like, they're not playing it on PC.
Yeah, I guess that's yeah. kind of the crux of yeah. where I'm worried about this is because yeah. I think a lot of games don't leverage those things.
Sure.
Or rather do so in a perfunctory way, and I think gamers are fine with it. But you're probably also right, which yeah. is that we just don't see how successful it is because there's not a lot of people don't talk about it that yeah. much. But it yeah. might be people might still be thrilled. They may even be making, if not purchase decisions, review decisions based on those things.
Yeah.
Even if they don't tell you, that's why.
Right. I will also say that, like, I think that gamers like are more expectant of these things from like first party developers.
Yeah.
Obviously, because like they are the ones who made. They're the ones who know the people who made the hardware, so they have better access mm-hmm. to it, and they know a lot more of the ins and outs of, like, a machine. So I think as an indie developer, if you're not interested in caring about that stuff, you're probably fine. But, like, I think people might, appreciate it. I don't know. Ellen, do you feel differently? How do you feel about it?
I think it really depends on your game yeah. and your goals, you know? Like, okay. I think, like, I mean, it was fun for Widget Satchel to have some of that.
Yeah.
Not that I worked on that piece at all, but like it was fun to, you know, it was fun to play it for those reasons. But yeah, I don't really play a ton. I play mostly on PC and mobile and some Switch. And so like, I know I'm not going to notice if it behaves differently on different platforms. And I think it'd be a rare case where you're like, having players notice that it does something on one platform versus another.
Mm-hmm.
And it's never like you're never going to plan for major features to do something like that.
Right.
Yeah. Right? Cause you then have to decide what happens to the platforms that don't get those features. Yeah. Are those lesser
exactly.
or, and then they just become bonus and they don't matter.
Yeah.
But I think Ellen, you spoke to something yeah. which is just like, there's a virtue in the consistency as much yeah. as it's kind of a bummer. For like a person like me who loves controllers to lament the fact that they're just all the same now.
Yeah.
Like I get the value. Like if you have two systems, you know, yeah. like not everyone's going to have everything. Right. And I still think most people play on one thing.
Right.
And that's what really you should be designing for. And in that mode, I still believe that. Mm. But when you think about the larger picture, like I guess you just want a parity of experience that is a virtue, even if it's a little bit of a bummer.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Is that kind of, Ellen, does that make sense with what you're thinking?
I mean, I think so. I think there's kind of like there's a reason why a lot of the controllers are the same.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah.
And it's because I think it's because it makes it the opportunity cost of switching isn't very high.
Yeah.
And so it's interesting to think about how you want to prioritize one platform over another. But I think it also really depends on how unique the gameplay you're making is. Because if you want to create something that's truly unique, then maybe leaning into some of those unique aspects of your system is one way to create a space where you can do that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You started this conversation, Mark, with like talking about the constraints, like setting up constraints for your design. And that could be one way that you do it. But then the trade-off is, like, you either have that unique feature has to not be a core aspect of the gameplay so that you have a good core gameplay experience across all different platforms, or you have to be willing to have a smaller audience because you're only really focusing on one.
Yeah, that's a really good note and a good one to end on, which is just like, designing for multiple platforms is a great goal, but you should be designing for the platforms that your design is suited for.
Right.
And yeah. so, like, a good example is, yeah. like, you know, Spider-Man 2 has that fast loading,
right.
you know, feature where you can, like, you know, zip across in a second. And, you know, they're putting that on PC.
Yeah.
I think it's out on PC. And you can get that with, like, the direct drive or, you know, whatever. But, like, the idea is it's meant for that platform. You couldn't put that on Switch.
Right.
Because it would be an experience not just different, but very much lesser.
Yeah.
And other than the fact that Nintendo or Sony doesn't publish Switch games, that's a reason to not put it on that platform.
Mm-hmm.
So the being deliberate is as important as being like aware of it's a two-way street, right?
Yeah.
What do your players expect from the platform and what do you expect from the platform? And
right.
if your design expects something from a platform and the platform doesn't have it, then maybe that's not a platform you ship on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very good point. It's been a little bit since we talked about GLOM.
Yeah.
I'm going to wait, pause here so Ellen can do the GLOM thing that she always does when we talk about it.
Oh, hit him. GLOM.
Perfect. Okay. Yeah.
I was looking at my watch to see how long that was taking, but my watch broke.
Oh, no.
No way. Are you serious?
Yeah. The whole time on the first topic, it was like buzzing at me. It's like having like a critical failure.
Oh, man.
Because it needed to know when it was time to die, and it thought this week was a great one.
Wow. You're not busy with anything.
All right, right, right. Moving
okay,
on.
Yeah. Okay, GLOM. We developed GLOM during a nice games jam, and we worked on it a bunch after the fact because we were like, this game is amazing. We want to keep working on it.
Mm-hmm.
And then we did, and we found a publisher thanks to Peter Gang, who's been on the show before, our friend. It's now on shelves. You can get it on shelves. You can find locations with which to purchase it, or you can buy it online at nicegames.club/GLOM. GLOM is a fun party game that you can play with a ton of different people, and it's short. It's a clever game you can play in 5 minutes. All you do is you have a phrase that you rewrite based off of a rule, you get scored based off of a goal card. That's the gist of it. You do it in 3 minutes, and then everybody gets to read out their GLOMs, and it's fun.
You know, when you said it could play with all sorts of people,
yeah.
I think that undersells one of the cool features about the game that we don't talk about a lot, which is it's like it can be played with like 2 to 100 players.
Yes, exactly.
We don't necessarily recommend 100 players.
Yeah.
But if you got like a dinner party going, and
put it
like,
up on a TV,
and you're like, oh, you know, they bring out this board game, but it only supports 6, and
yeah.
We've got 7 or 8 people here.
Yeah.
GLOM's for you.
Mm-hmm.
Like it's expandable, and it's even funnier when more people contribute.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You get so many different GLOMs. It's a blast. Go to nicegames.club/GLOM and check it out.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices. Plus, extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Do you want to spend time on your watch or we just...
No, it's going to beep at me again, but I'm going to be just leaving it alone.
Okay.
It's just in the throes of... I don't know what kind of death. It's never happened to this watch before.
Oh, boy. Okay.
Whatever.
I hope it gets better.
Yeah.
All right. My topic is... What did we say it? Hold on. Let's start over.
Well, you brought up GLOM in the middle of the show.
I did.
Because you just want to get us in the board game mood.
Yeah, that's why I did it.
Right?
Not because I, like, have these things scheduled out or anything. Yeah. Right. I've been working on a custom spirit for Spirit Island. And, you know, I've talked about Spirit Island a lot on the show because it's one of my obsessions.
Yeah, we got to rewind the tape. Like, let's just start with definitions. What is Spirit Island?
Yeah, Spirit Island is a board game. It's a cooperative board game where you play as a bunch of spirits protecting an island from colonial European settlers. That's the gist of it. The problem with this topic is, like, in order for me to really get into the details of what I'm doing for this custom spirit, I have to explain how Spirit Island works. And that's 30 minutes of content.
Buckle in.
Yeah, y'all don't want that.
We'll link some resources in the show.
Yeah, we can link to there's a wiki page and stuff that I've been
using.
Yeah,
I'm curious. I would like, because I've played the game, I think, 2 or 3 times now.
Mm-hmm.
And but I still would have to relearn it the next time I play, probably.
Sure.
So I'll try to be a barometer. I don't know how familiar with the game you are, Ellen, but I think, let's see how much we can get out of this, because I think it's been something on your mind for a long time.
Yes.
And so I'm really happy you brought it to the show.
Yeah.
Even if it's like we don't know what we're in for.
Yeah. Ellen, have you played Spirit Island before?
Mm-hmm. Okay. I have not.
Oh, gosh. Okay. Well, I picked the top.
Well, we're going to go visit Ellen in Duluth in a couple of weeks.
Well, I guess we should bring Spirit Island.
Maybe we should spend the whole weekend doing that.
That'd be pretty sweet.
You say that now. I've been working on this custom spirit for Spirit Island for a few months now, I think, just on and off. Like, this isn't a... I'm not spending 40 hours a week doing on this because, like,
I don't... We got to rewind the tape again because this is... So, this is a thing that a lot of people have done.
Yes.
Is make a custom expansion.
Yeah. Right? So there's a bunch, like you can go on the Reddit or you can find the Spirit Island Discord and stuff like that. There's a bunch of people making custom spirits for things because the game's really fun and a lot of people play it.
Mm-hmm.
And they just, you know, the specifically Spirit Island has a wide design space.
Mm-hmm.
It's built that way. And so a lot of people are just like, oh, okay, I'll just like recreate Avatar from the Last Airbender and put it in the game. You know, like unironically, I saw a spirit the other day that was like this. A lot of people are, you know, just creating a bunch of different content for it because like they're really passionate about the game and mm-hmm. that's what you do is you make cool stuff for a game that you like.
And broadly, a spirit is a character with stats, kind of like a D&D class, in a sense.
It's effectively the character you're playing as. When you play the game, you play as a spirit.
Mm-hmm.
And these spirits have, they're not humans. They're sort of alien-y in that, like, they kind of represent, like, a specific aspect of the island. So, like, you could play as River, and that's you playing as, like, a bunch of rivers, and you kind of feel a little bit like a river when you're playing it.
Right. Things so there's like a big thematic element.
Yes, exactly. Each spirit has a ton of different, like, specificities that make them feel differently. I'll list them out. I'm not going to explain them because they're too long. There's special rules, there's innate powers, there's unique power cards, there's growth tracks, there's growth options. There's probably more that I'm forgetting. There's specific, like, elements that each spirit wants to try to get to, that is also important. It's just a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
But, like, as a result, you get a big, wide a space with which to work with. It's like if you wanted to like design a fighting game character, right? For Street Fighter, there's like, you know, Street Fighter has a bunch of, each character has a bunch of different unique moves and things like that to make them feel special. And so like if you wanted to design a Street Fighter character and put it in the game, you'd have to put all these things in, including like maybe different health stats and things, because some Street Fighter games have different health, each character has different health stats and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
So Spirit Island has that kind of stuff, too. And the combination of all of these things creates, like, a thematic connection so that, like, you sort of feel like what that spirit is supposed to feel like. So I talked about River is one of them. There's one where you could play as the ocean, and you, like, are trying to get things into the ocean so you get more energy and you could get more things in the ocean. The spirit that I most like playing that's an official spirit is called Vengeance. Vengeance as a Burning Plague, which is my favorite spirit.
Let's not read too much into that.
Yeah. but that one's really fun because, like, basically, like, when your presence, which is how you're represented on the board, when your presence dies, it turns into a disease, and then, like, you use that disease to hurt the invaders. So, like, they hit you, so you hit back. Mm-hmm. It's fun. And I really like disease as a concept, I guess. So like my spirit is based around that idea. A lot of, most of the spirits don't use like this disease tokens. Most spirits don't use disease tokens that much. So that's part of why I was like, I should make a spirit that does this. So like I went in it from that perspective. So my spirit is supposed to feel like a disease. It's supposed to feel like a plague that like invaders are trying to shake off, but they can't. It's just constantly an annoyance.
Right. It's called phlegm.
Yeah. Maybe that's an idea for the name. I haven't come up with a good name for the spirit yet.
Yeah.
So right now, the way that the special rule works is whenever you, my spirit special rule is kind of like the core of what your spirit is. The special rule for this spirit is when you push invaders or other living objects around on the board, your presence, which is again what presents you, moves along with it. So like, you know, the invaders are like, oh, I'm sick of this, all of this illness and stuff, I'm gonna move to a different land, it's probably better there, and then haha, no, actually you go with them. So that's kind of the intention.
Yeah. And that changes a lot because normally mechanically there's lots of strategies about like positioning,
yes,
the various invaders and natives versus the spirit's presence.
Yeah.
And so this just uses those same mechanics, but everything's very different now.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Initially, I was kind of trying to be too broad with the idea of this. Like, I took a bunch of inspiration from a bunch of different things, because diseases, you know, there's a lot of diseases in the world. And so, like, I was just like, well, we'll throw this in. And so, like, eventually, the thematics of the spirit that I was creating didn't make any sense because like there was just so much stuff going on. So eventually I went back and I read this guy that I'll link to in the show notes that really helped me figure out how to better direct what I was doing and really simplify things down. And so like I simplified it down to this one special rule, and then I'm starting to build the spirit out based off of this special rule. Like knowing that when you push invaders to a different land, and your presence goes along with it, what would that mean? How would that be interesting? What kind of powers would be interesting to work along with that specific thing?
Mm-hmm.
So like I've just been tweaking a bunch of stuff now. It's still, I haven't like finished a lot of the details of it yet, but I've been changing things here and there to try to see if I can get something interesting going on. One thing I do want to say about this is that like I haven't actually playtested yet.
Mm.
And people are like, Steven, you always say playtest your stuff. And yes, you should. And you still should, listener. Yeah, don't try to come at me. I guess if you think I'm wrong, put it in the feedback form. But
come to Discord and tell Steven why he's wrong.
Or that too, yeah. But what I have been doing is I've been posting what I've been like working on in a Discord. There's a Spirit of Creation Discord. We can link to that too. That like people who make a lot of custom spirits or are interested in making custom spirits go to like for community purposes.
Yeah.
Like they can show what they're working on and things like that. So like I've been asking for feedback from them because I'm very new to this. I'm not new to designing, but I am new to designing things for Spirit Island, and it feels different because like I'm specifically making it within a system that somebody else created. In a way that is unique to my experience. Most of the time when I'm designing something, it's from scratch, you know, or I understand the system already, and so it's easier for me to create content for it.
Yeah.
This is a system that I know how to play, but I don't know how to develop for. So it feels different. And so I've been asking for feedback from that, and that is my form of playtesting, at least for the time being. And I don't want to – I think I've fallen into this trap before. I don't want to get attached to something if I, like, playtest it, and I'm like, this is really cool. Because like it might not actually still fit with the spirit that I want to create. Like I haven't figured out the design pillars effectively yet.
Hmm.
So I didn't want to play test it without knowing what the core of the spirit is. Now I have a better understanding of it, and so it would make more sense for me to play test it once I actually have enough content to do that.
Right.
But I'm getting to that point. When I get to that point, you better believe when we play testing the heck out of the spirit. So yeah, so why am I doing this? Why am I creating a custom spirit for Spirit Island? Partly because I'm already thinking about the game too much as it is, so I might as well make something productive out of it.
Quote unquote productive.
Touche. but also I think that like ever since I've been like getting paid to work on games, and I work on 8 hours of my day, I've had less energy to like work on side projects relating to making games.
It's not your hobby anymore.
It's not my hobby anymore, right? Yeah. I get paid to it. I do it a lot now, and I have to, and I like I get paid to think about game. I mean, even this podcast, right? Like, we don't get paid a lot.
We really don't.
we
Patreon.com/nicegame,
but
please. Yeah.
No, we cover our costs, sort of.
Yeah, exactly.
If we blur our eyes and cross our fingers. Some costs are covered.
But we still do, game design things on here. Like, we just did a game jam, things like that. And so, like, I haven't felt as much drive to work on something.
Oh, has that really scratched the itch for you mostly?
It has helped. It has helped a lot. Yeah, yeah. Because, I think I've talked about this on the show before. When I go to bed, I like to think about a problem and fall asleep and half remember what I figured out. When I wake up, it just helps me fall asleep.
Yeah.
And so, like, I'll think about the spirit while I'm going to bed. And I find that nice because then I'll be thinking about this. And I'm like, oh, this is a good idea. And then,
And there's no deadlines for it. There's no accountability to how well you half remembered it.
Yeah, there's no way I'm going to get paid to make this thing, which makes it feel less like I don't have to be as responsible for it. And, like, I think also, like, due to the fact that I'm still the only programmer at Future Club, even though like people want me to do some design work for Future Club, and I want to do design work for Future Club, it is hard to prioritize that when if I'm doing design work, there's no code getting made.
Yeah.
So I oftentimes don't get to do the designs, some of the design stuff that I would like to do, and this gives me a little bit of that outlet. So that's been nice. It's a nice change of pace. I hope that me being, I was vague enough that people could get into it, but specific enough that people who are interested in Spirit Island are curious. I can link to the, I have a Discord channel in the Spirit of Creation Discord about my spirit. I could link to that in the show notes as well.
Yeah.
But yeah, because y'all understand like kind of the gist of what I was talking about. It was pretty broad.
Yeah. Well, you're talking about modding.
Yeah,
effectively. But it's definitely different for board games.
Yes.
You know? And yeah, because those games take so long to play, I think a lot of it, like you say, the playtesting is just about the feedback you're getting from other people.
Yeah.
Do you worry about that being really insular, or is that, that's the audience, so maybe that's fine?
I am worried about that. It would be nice if I could play test the spirit at like a playtest event here.
Yeah.
But in order to do that, I have to teach people how to play Spirit Island, and it's just going to take too long. I'm not good at teaching the game.
You know, you could recruit some folks on the local Discord who know how to play the game and say, hey, come to the next playtest. And then
that would work.
Yeah.
That's a good
idea. We can get that set up.
Yeah. Yeah. So there's like options. And I mean, I know plenty of friends who would be interested in playing a weird new spirit too. And I'll probably like, I guess I'll have to like ask folks, who I've never played a game with before, if they're interested in playing. But I would, the main thing is I would like to get like new players' perspectives, not necessarily people who haven't played the game before, but like people who have played maybe 2-3 games.
Mark. Oh no.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm in.
Oh, okay. Cool.
I'll be your persistent cough.
Sweet. I am a little worried about that. I guess it's the same thing with like any kind of playtesting. Like with Fendence, you know, when we had at playtest proper, we would bring it every however often the event would happen. And because I forget now,
it was back 100 years ago.
It like swapped. So I don't remember which one it was. But we bring it every time, and like people would eventually get accustomed to Fendence, and so like our playtests, our pool would be like people who were more experienced at the game, and I think that we lost some of the ability to see like a new player's perspective as a result of that.
Right.
Which is just going to happen if you play test with the same group of people all the time. So like you have to bring it to new faces in order for you to get that new experience play testing. And there's, you know, there's tons of new people to be able to play a game, but it's difficult to convince them to play a game for even like Fingence's short gameplay loop. It's sometimes difficult to just convince them to do that because like they're doing their own things.
Yeah.
So it's nice to have the event, but like then you know you get the same people. So, at any rate, yeah, I'm worried about that, but I'll figure it out.
Well, but also again, you're not accountable to anything. So
yes.
that's the other thing that I think is really interesting about this topic is like you said, it scratches that itch and like lets you engage in the practice in a way that's like much safer.
Yeah.
And less consequential. Like you say, you're worried about I asked about that insularity because that's something I'm very much worried about in games in general.
Yeah.
When people say like, "Oh, I made this game for me, the hardcore 4X player." It's like, great, but like,
who else is gonna play it?
Yeah. And but I think in this case, it's actually well suited for that, and I would maybe be less worried about that. Partly because it is the audience.
Yeah.
That is you're not in, it's not supposed to work for people outside that group.
True.
Which isn't to say that isn't a laudable goal.
Yeah.
But the second thing is if you fail at designing it for the right audience, fine.
Yeah. I guess that's true.
Right?
The stakes are so low.
Yeah. So I think Ellen, I want to ask you about, because we talked about nice games jams.
Yeah.
Like, Ellen, as a professional game designer who's moved into a new role recently, that doesn't let you design as much during the day. Do you have things like, you know, in your back pocket or, you know, stuff to sort of scratch that itch as a hobby the way that Steven is doing?
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't because I just don't have the energy. I still get to do a little bit of game design. You know, a lot of the specifics are handled by another designer now.
Yeah.
Okay.
And so I'm more thinking about like how to frame the big picture and working with customers and stuff like that. But a lot of emotional energy being spent at work.
Sure.
Just because now it's like dealing with people
and
like building understanding and thinking about systems still, like the systems of how people work together kind of pulls upon a lot of the same brain space that game design does.
Yeah.
And so it's just, it's not exactly game design, but like it's still pulling from the same neurons. And so it ended up being just kind of fried. Sure. I'm hoping that like as the team evolves, I'll get some of that time and energy back. Because I do have some things like that I think about while I'm trying to fall asleep. Or I'm walking the dog.
Yeah.
It's like every time I walk a dog, I'm like, oh, I love walking the dog because I have another game I want to design. And it's like, oh, I'm not going to get it. Add it to the notebook so I can come back to it.
Yeah.
I sometimes think about like, oh, you know, it'd be great to have like a gap year, like take a work sabbatical for like 6 months or a year and just do stuff.
Yeah.
But I don't think I'm at a place in my career right now where I can make that happen. Give me another 10 years, I can probably do it. But
yeah. I do sometimes fantasize about us just dropping everything and then just taking like six of our nice games jams the course of a year and just working full time on them.
Yeah.
Because every one of those episodes with like, oh man, this would be great if we could work on it.
Yeah. That would be nice.
But speaking of, we're going to visit Ellen in the next couple of weeks, you and I. We're going to truck up there. Ellen's going to host us. Mm-hmm. And one of the reasons, I mean, it's an excuse to hang out with Ellen, but and we'll take any.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But we're going to work on Robustin a little bit.
Yeah.
And again, no, we're not, you know, we're just, we play tested it recently and we've talked about it on the show about how we're all lamenting the fact that it sort of isn't going to get a lot of attention. And we're now getting frustrated by the lack of attention that we're giving it. And so we're going to give it some attention and see what we have with it.
Yeah.
We're no expectations, but, and it's going to be, you're going to be doing a little bit of what you're doing with Spirit Island. You're going to be building content within the system we've designed, which is a much smaller design space intentionally. But I'm actually kind of curious how much you can bend it.
Yeah. Oh, good question.
Because I think that'll be a virtue.
This is, that's the, like, that, when you get, like, the base of something done, and then, like, you're just doing the little tweaks, that's my sweet spot. I'm almost there. I'm not quite there with the spirit. But when I get to that point, I'm like, that's going to feel great.
There's two things that Stephen gets really fired up about.
Yep.
One is spreadsheets, and the other is breaking things.
Well, beating my brother in games, that's also a third, that's a third thing.
Three things.
Can you incorporate that into your spirit?
He's terrible at Spirit Island, so it's like default.
Oh, nice. That's why you like it so much. That's our show. For show notes and links on today's topics, go to our website, nicegames.club. Visit us on social media at Nice Games Club, where Dale posts about game dev resources and Steam on Startup. Reply on the various platforms or email us, contact@nicegames.club. We are on Patreon. You can support the show and you can get stuff, including ad-free episodes. Sign up at patreon.com/nicegamesclub. And if you want to keep things more casual or tell Steven that he's wrong, just by nicegames.club/discord and say hello. Next week, we'll be talking with Dave McKee about game accessibility. That's it for this week.
So, until we start again, remember to
play nice
and make nice. One extra thing.
Oh,
hold on. While we were talking about this, I did a bit of graphic note taking.
Uh-huh.
Oh.
And I will share it with you now, and we can put this on the B-roll.
Uh-huh.
I did it in Paint.
I'm excited to see this.
I put it on the screen share.
Oh, on screen share.
Yeah. Oh, I could post it into the chat.
No, we just have you full screen on the thing, so we don't see that.
So, yeah. Do you see it now?
That's the image.
I like it. It's the correct aspect ratio and everything.
Test on potatoes.
Little deets.
Okay, all right. The little deets.
Yeah, that's pretty good.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger for thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
People are driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. The hiring process can be slow and overwhelming. Simplify hiring with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. Listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/PODKATZ12. That's Indeed.com/PODKATZ12. Terms and conditions apply.